Water Sustainer Program. Make a difference today. This is KPFT Houston.
Good evening, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to Arab Voices on Houston Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. We will be talking about Syria today. Originally, we had the guest, Suzanne Mirdan, Director of Operations at the Syrian American Council, scheduled to be our guest. However, she is stuck at the airport in Atlanta because of the storm, so obviously she is not here right now. However, we might have another guest joining us during the next hour or so, and that's by the film director Sam Qadi, who is on his way to Houston. may have landed, and we are hoping to have him on the show during this hour. So we will be talking about Syria regardless, and I want to start now with the community calendar. And I'll start with the film screening, the film that's called Little Randy, that's directed by Sam Qadi. So this film, the name of the film, Little Randy, will be screened right here in Houston tomorrow and Friday. The film tells the heart-wrenching and tragic tale of iconic Syrian peace activist Riyath Mattar. The story of Mattar, dubbed Little Randy for his strict code of nonviolent protest, takes viewers through the Syrian people's peaceful pursuit of freedom and democracy, only to be met with live ammunition from the Syrian regime. While the documentary follows the journey of a young man dedicated to peaceful change and the international attention his story received, it also reflects the plight of all Syrians in their long flight for freedom. Little Randy film is the winner of Excellence in Filmmaking Award at the 2016 European Independent Film Festival in Paris, and the Best Foreign Documentary at the 21st International Family Film Festival in Los Angeles. The screening of the film in Houston will take place tomorrow, December 1st, at Rice University. And on Friday, it will be screened at the University of Houston. Both screenings will feature the film director, Sam Qadi. So, at the Rice University tomorrow, it's going to be at 7 p.m. And on Friday, December 2nd, at the University of Houston, it will be at 2 p.m. More information and more details about that is on our website, arabvoices.net, and I will be talking about more about the film and more information about it later during the show. In the wake of the 2016 presidential election, many people are feeling disenfranchised and unwelcome in their chosen or native home due to xenophobic and Islamophobic rhetoric. So a day of solidarity with Houston's Muslims is being scheduled for this Friday, December 2nd, from 1 p.m. to 3:30 p.m. It is organized to show Houston's Muslim families that they are accepted and welcome in their own country, the United States of America. The event will be held at the Islamic Society of Greater Houston on 3110 East Side Street, and the timing will coincide with the Friday prayer services. Demonstrators will also have the opportunity to enter the mosque and experience an Islam 101 workshop. The Arab American Cultural and Community Center, ACC, invites you for a Taste of a Night on the Nile event. It will be a family evening of cultural immersion experience and will include Egyptian and Sudanese folklore, country display booth of artifacts and traditional items, booths for henna and calligraphy, and ethnic food and dessert from Egypt and Sudan. Babysitting, fun activities, movie, pizza, and drinks will also be available and included in the children ticket. This event will be held on December 3rd, that's this Saturday, at 6:30 p.m. at the Arab American Cultural and Community Center on 10555 Stancliff Road. For more information, visit acchouston.org. The Arab American Cultural and Community Center is also launching English classes for adults starting this Saturday, December 3rd. The ACC will be offering two levels, level one for beginners, suitable for those with no prior formal knowledge of English, and level two is appropriate for those seeking to improve on their English for work or school advancement purposes or for their own self-motivation. Both levels will initially meet weekly at the ACC on Saturdays from 1 to 3 p.m. with their respective teachers. For more information, call 832-351-3366 or send email to school@acchouston.org. The Baker Institute Center for the Middle East at Rice University will hold an event titled Syria, Policy Options for the Trump Administration. Since 2011, Syria's Arab uprising has devolved into civil war and humanitarian disaster. Thousands have been killed and millions displaced internally and externally. Radical groups have spawned with destabilizing consequences for the country, the region, and the globe. The wars in Iraq and Syria have severely challenged the Middle East state system and opened the door for renewed international interventions. The Trump administration faces a daunting task and inherits a reign in turmoil with an unclear way forward. On December 13th at 6:30 p.m., the Baker Institute Center for the Middle East hosts a panel of recognized Syria experts to discuss the key issues and possible policy options for the new U.S. administration. There will be several speakers at the event, and it will be moderated by Edward Djerjian, director of the Baker Institute and former U.S. ambassador to Syria and Israel. For more information or to register, visit bakerinstitute.org. Marcel Khalifa and his two sons, Rami and Bashar Khalifa, will be performing live at the Day for Night Visually Immersive Art and Music Festival next month. Their performance will be on Sunday, December 18th at 5:30 p.m. Of course, Marcel Khalifa is world-renowned Lebanese composer, vocalist, and oud master who has been performing across the globe since the early 70s. Marcel Khalifa has more than 24 releases and is widely regarded for his humanitarian pursuits. In 1999, he was granted the Palestine Award for Music. In 2005, he was named UNESCO Artist for Peace. For more information, visit dayfornight.io. There are many other events scheduled in the greater Houston area. For a comprehensive list of all of those events, visit our website, and that's arabvoices.net. We're going to take a break now, and we ask you to stay tuned because we will have several things to cover. You're listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. We'll be right back.
لما بتقتل تذكر عم تقتل خيك ولما تهدم تذكر عم تهدم بيتك لما تقتل تذكر عم تقتل خيك ولما بتهدم تذكر عم تهدم بيتك سوريا موجوعة عم تنزف دموع سوريا موجوعة عم تنزف دموع عولاد كانوا شموعة عأهل صاروا غرابة عأهل صاروا غرابة واسكابة يا دموع اسكابة بالدم تعطر ترابة اسكابة يا دموع اسكابة بالدم تعطر عأهل صاروا غرابة عأهل صاروا غرابة
Welcome back to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM. You're listening to Arab Voices. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of the show. Now, the guest is on his way to this station, and he should be here in about 20 minutes. I just received the text. He landed in Houston, and that's Sam Qadi. He is the film director of the film Little Gandhi that will be screened tomorrow and Friday right here in Houston about Syria. So for those 20 minutes, what I'm going to do now is I'm going to air an interview that I conducted on this show about 2 or 3 months ago, actually 2 months ago in September, with Gareth Porter, an American historian, investigative journalist, author, and policy analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy. I spoke to him about Syria, the ceasefire at that time that was called for, and we spoke for about 20 minutes or so. So let me go ahead and air that interview with Gareth Porter, and once our guest arrives at the station, we will speak live with Sam Qadi. Here's the interview I did with Gareth Porter. Welcome back to Arab Voices on Houston's Pacifica Radio, listener-sponsored, commercial-free KPFT 90.1 FM, with live streaming, podcasting, and online archive of previous shows at both kpft.org and arabvoices.net. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Joining us now live via phone is Gareth Porter. He is an American historian, investigative journalist, author, and policy analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy. He has written several books about the potential for peaceful conflicts resolution in Southeast Asia and the Middle East, including Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. Porter has reported extensively on Middle East conflicts, including Syria. His analysis and reporting have appeared in academic journals, news publications, and periodicals for 4 decades. And in 2012, he was the winner of the Martha Gellhorn Prize for Journalism. Gareth, welcome to Arab Voices.
Thank you so much, Saeed. Glad to be on your show.
Thanks. We're glad to have you on the show. We would like to talk about Syria today and the latest developments there. For so many years, it has been a complete catastrophe, as we all know, with hundreds of thousands dead, millions of refugees within their own country and outside of their own country, more than half of the population of Syria. We are witnessing the destruction of a country, but supposedly a ceasefire was reached on Saturday and took effect this Monday. What could you share with our listeners about this latest ceasefire brokered between the U.S. and Russia?
Well, it's still very much a question mark how this ceasefire is going to work out in terms of whether it can survive. The first ceasefire, as I think your listeners know pretty well, was relatively successful for the first few weeks. In fact, the level of fatalities was apparently reduced by as much as 90% at one point during March of this year. The current ceasefire has a chance to have a similar outcome, at least for some weeks. But I have to tell you that my main concern at this point is that based on both the outcome of the history of the first ceasefire and what we know about the positions of the various forces and the parties to the present war, one has to believe that the greatest likelihood is that the jihadist factions led by formerly al-Nusra Front, now Jabhat Al-Fatah al-Sham, they are likely to have a plan to violate the ceasefire in a major way, as they did in April of this year. So I think the first consideration here is really what are the incentives for the various parties to abide by the ceasefire. And we know from the people who have been in touch with the former al-Nusra Front, the al-Qaeda franchise in Syria, as well as from statements that have been issued in the current situation in regard to the current ceasefire, that the incentive for the jihadists in Syria now is negative. They do not have an incentive to abide by the ceasefire, they regard it as a way of frustrating the what they call the revolution. And so that is really the biggest single factor, in my view, that limits the prospects for the ceasefire to continue for very long.
So there are, as I understand it, there are two groups fighting in Syria that are excluded from this latest ceasefire agreement, supposedly by all parties, and that is, as you mentioned, Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, and also ISIS, right?
That's correct. They are subject, once the ceasefire has taken hold, both those groups are subject to what is supposed to develop, according to the ceasefire agreement, which is a joint U.S.-Russian campaign to target both Daesh and the al-Qaeda forces in Syria. So you know that it's true that both those forces are excluded from the benefits, if you will, of the ceasefire, except insofar as they are able to avoid the being bombed by the U.S. and Russia. Should, in fact, that joint campaign actually get underway, and I emphasize that this is still an idea at this point. It is not a reality. It has not been worked out in detail exactly how it's going to work. It still has to be negotiated between the United States and the U.S. and Russian military leaderships. And it's not clear that the U.S. will necessarily go along with the proposals that the Russians make. But in any case, the key point is one that you've correctly made. That is that al-Nusra Front, former al-Nusra Front, now Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, is not supposed to enjoy the same benefits as other Syrian forces.
Now, obviously, we're talking about the Syrian government and the Syrian forces on one side, and the so-called opposition on the other side. But over the years, we have seen that opposition tumble. It is not one single entity standing. How is it now? So whom are they dealing with from the other side when they are talking about a ceasefire? Are they dealing with, and I'm talking about the U.S. and Russia, are they dealing with individual groups? Or is there an umbrella again that all of those oppositions and fighters fall under to speak on behalf of the opposition?
There are various groupings that have been created, including, of course, the National Negotiating Council of opposition groups. But I think the real answer is what you've suggested in your question, which is that there is no true umbrella organization that speaks for or can speak on behalf of all of the opposition forces, or even those opposition forces that are that have called themselves in the past, at least, Free Syrian Army or FSA, and have received military assistance directly from the CIA. And so that is a serious question about the way in which this ceasefire could work. But I think even more serious, if you will, as an issue of a problem for the operation of the ceasefire is that these non-jihadist opposition forces, the ones that have in the past been supported by the CIA, have made it known through various means, again, through people who've interviewed them, who've talked with them, and as well in terms of the first ceasefire, directly entering a public statement on behalf of, if I remember correctly, 36 of these organizations, that they would not participate in a ceasefire that excluded any other parties, that was not a ceasefire that was enjoyed by everyone. In other words, they were refusing to participate in a ceasefire that the al-Qaeda people were not fully partners in. And so there's every reason to believe that in this ceasefire. It's not just the jihadists, but also the so-called, I emphasize the so-called moderates, who are not inclined to honor the ceasefire. Now, how that exactly is going to work out, when they might make the decision to break out of the ceasefire, I certainly don't have an answer to. But again, I think there's a very serious issue here, or a serious question of the incentives from their point of view for continuing to abide by the ceasefire for a lengthy period of time.
Now, with this ceasefire, supposedly went into effect Monday evening or so we are like 2 days into it. Do you know how good that ceasefire is holding? And one of the main points, I believe, from what I've read of this ceasefire, is to allow humanitarian aid and civil traffic to cities, especially Aleppo, which has been devastated lately by the fightings and so on. And has any humanitarian aid, was it able to get in to any of those cities, or Aleppo at least?
Well, to answer that, that second part of your question first, I mean, the answer is, at least the last time I checked, I've not checked for the last few hours, the humanitarian aid had not crossed the Turkish border. Now, the immediate question that appears to have hung up the arrival or the crossing of the border and the arrival of the humanitarian aid is the Syrian government's complaint that the Turkish government is taking upon itself to carry the relief goods or the humanitarian goods into the places where it is supposed to be targeted. And they're saying that this should not be a Turkish function, that this should be something that's done by the Syrian government itself. Now, I don't know how that's going to play out, whether they will reach an agreement or whether it's going to continue to prevent the humanitarian aid from going through. But there's a second problem here that even if that issue, assuming that issue is resolved, which I suppose it's most likely that it will, there's a second problem, which is that the jihadist factions have let it be known that they are not necessarily going to tolerate these humanitarian shipments going into Aleppo if, in their view, it's part of what they call a humiliating deal. That's in quotes, a humiliating deal. That's really a remarkable statement from a jihadist organization allied with or aligned with, I guess I should say, Jabhat al-Fatah al-Sham, but it appears that they are threatening to disrupt the operation as a protest against the agreement itself. Now, of course, it's possible that they're just blowing off steam and that doesn't really mean anything, but that at least is a threat that has been made publicly.
So with obviously the aid now is on hold at the Turkish border and so on, trying to get in into desperately needed areas in Syria. When we talk about Turkey, there is also Iran, there is also the Gulf states. There are so many external countries, external powers that have their hands dirty and blood all over their hands in what's happening in Syria for the past 5 years or so, whether it's Turkey, the U.S., Russia, Iran, the Gulf states, the Syrian government, the opposition, all those groups. There are so many external factors involved. Where do these all stand, to your knowledge, from this ceasefire brokered between the U.S. and Russia? For example, Iran, where does it stand, and where does the Turkey stand and those Gulf states?
Well, no, that's a complicated question.
Because they supposedly pour in arms by the billions into those fighters and those operating within Syria.
Right. Well, I mean, each country has a slightly different angle, of course, in terms of their interest regarding the ceasefire and the issues surrounding it. Now, I mean, the Iranians have, as far as I know, have indicated that they are supporting the ceasefire. They've not raised any question about it. Turkey has done likewise. I think the outside powers have all publicly declared their support for the ceasefire. Now, the problem, I think that you're suggesting, if I understand fully the implications of your question, is are they all willing to make to pursue policies which will in fact help to calm the situation down rather than exacerbating and returning the situation to a state of war? And in this regard, I mean, I have to say that my main concern is, of course, that Turkey's position, Turkey's policy, because they quite simply control the spigot in terms of arms coming into the country that have been the fuel for the Al-Qaeda and other groups that have been supported by the United States and the Sunni outside states. If Turkey were to adopt a policy that said, okay, it's time for this situation to be calmed down and not to take advantage of any opportunity to resume the shipment of arms across the border to their clients, particularly, you know, their main client has been Arar al-Sham. I know I'm not pronouncing it right because I don't speak Arabic, but I hope your listeners will pardon that.
No, that's
that,
fine.
Weakness on my part, but Turkey has in the past clearly they did not support the first ceasefire. They did in fact make a decision with Saudi Arabia and Qatar on the eve of the announcement of the first ceasefire in late February this year. They made a decision to reinforce. To resupply their clients in Syria. And as a result of that, in fact, some of the clients, including Arar al-Sham, received shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles, or manpads, in which they used to shoot down two Syrian aircraft in the period of March and April. So clearly Turkey was not acting to support the first ceasefire. Now, I hope that this will not be the case with the present ceasefire, and the hope would be founded on a shift in Turkish policy, which I think all of your listeners are aware of, that has come over the last month or so, in particular reflecting the Turkish primary concern to hold back or to push back the Kurdish gains territorially in Syria that have taken place over the past year or two. And to the extent that the Turks are primarily concerned with the question of what they regard as the danger of the Kurdish mini-state in northern Syria, it has been suggested, and I think I've suggested this myself, that they may be more willing to try to strike a deal that could result in the extension of the ceasefire. But at this point, it's much too soon to say what their policy is going to be toward the ceasefire.
Now, obviously, if the ceasefire works, and their ultimate goal, I think, after that is to begin peace talks towards a solution to the problem, maybe a resumption of political dialogue between the Syrian government and the opposition under the United Nations umbrella at that time, which happened before and it didn't work. And if they succeed, so that maybe they can come up to a resolution to this catastrophe in Syria. Do you see that possible down the road?
Well, I'm sad to say, I'm sorry to say that, you know, for quite some time now, for many months, I have been very pessimistic about the idea of a negotiated solution to this, at least in the short run. As long as the war itself still has life in it, I foresee no real progress toward a political solution. I think that there has to be a fundamental change in the situation regarding the war before that could be possible. And I'll spell out my thinking a bit more clearly, mm-hmm. because otherwise it could be misconstrued. I think there are fundamentally two problems. One is that, and I think the most important problem, Okay, I'll reformulate that statement. I think there are two fundamental problems which are roughly equal in importance. I think on one side that we know that the jihadists in Syria really have no interest in a negotiated solution. They're not interested in a solution that preserves the state apparatus of the Syrian government. They are determined, in fact, to have a revolution which starts all over again and which establishes a completely different regime, which is a very traditional sort of jihadist Wahhabi Sunni type regime, a very strict Islamist regime. And so, you know, it's really not realistic to expect that you could have negotiations as long as those forces remain in the field, are being reinforced, still have hopes and capabilities to try to gain power. On the other side, I think that there is a serious issue, a serious problem with regard to the motivation of the Syrian government, with regard to making the kind of concessions that, or concession that has been demanded in the past, which is that President Bashar al-Assad stepped down. And the reason for that is quite simple, and that is that the Assad regime represents a minority Alawite set of interests, and they regard themselves, and quite realistically so, I think, as essentially fighting for the survival of the Alawite community within Syria, because if the forces that are now facing them, dominated by the Al-Qaeda folks, were to succeed, the Alawite community would certainly be endangered. Certainly its cultural survival would be threatened, if not its physical survival. And so given that factor, and given the fact that the security apparatus of the Assad regime is heavily dominated by the Alawites, it is their view that to have the president step down would be a serious threat to the stability of the regime. That would endanger the ability of the regime to continue. That there would be a signal for the beginning of an unwinding of the regime. So there's strong resistance to that. I think it's not likely to happen. It's very unlikely to happen. And that the kind of negotiated resolution that could be obtained is one that would involve the kind of revision of the Constitution that the Russians have put forward as reported by the pro-Hezbollah newspaper in Lebanon, which I think is accurate, that they have proposed a very wide-ranging number of revisions of reforms to the Constitution, which would give greater representation to other regions outside the Alawite region and Damascus, which would give more opportunities for Sunnis as a community to be represented in the government, and which would give much more power to regions than they now have. That at least is conceivable. I'm not suggesting that it's likely, but it is at least conceivable that that could happen. But that's very different from what I think not only the opposition forces are saying that they're fighting for, but it's also very different from what the United States and its allies have been demanding.
Yeah, and also not to forget that even this brokered ceasefire between those parties led by the U.S. and Russia, that the United States and Russia themselves, they still don't have full trust of each other when it comes to Syria and many other issues. So we don't even know how that will hold and who will do what with this ceasefire. One can only hope with this catastrophe in Syria that the ceasefire will hold so humanitarian aid can get into the Syrian people, the fightings, the bombings can stop, and maybe we can see a light at the end of this tunnel for the Syrian people. Unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it at this because we are out of time. Our guest this evening, Gareth Porter, an American historian, investigative journalist, author, and policy analyst specializing in U.S. national security policy, has been our guest. Thank you, Gareth, so much. We greatly appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
And I will have a link to your latest article that you published yesterday called Al-Qaeda's Ties to U.S.-Backed Syrian Rebel. We'll have it on our website, arabvoices.net. It's also posted on the consortium news. All right, so you are listening to Arab Voices on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of the show. What you just heard was an interview I conducted live on this program 2 months ago in September with Gareth Porter, an American historian, investigative journalist, author, and policy analyst. We were talking about Syria at that time. And now we are joined live in the studios of KPFT right here in Houston with Sam Qadi, who just arrived to Houston, literally landed at the airport, took a cab, and came here directly to the station. Sam Qadi is a director and producer of the award-winning American feature drama The Citizen. The Citizen received 5 awards on the festival circuit before being released theatrically worldwide in 2013. The film was named among the best 10 films of 2013 by Examiner.com. Sam Qadi has been recognized by the prestigious Cinema for Peace organization for raising awareness of human rights issues through motion pictures, and was asked to speak on the same subject before the International Criminal Court at The Hague, Netherlands, in June 2012. In 2013, he was presented with a Humanitarian Service Award by the Life for Relief and Development Organization. He is a member of the Directors Guild of America, where he serves on the Directors Guild Asian American Committee. And, of course, he is director of the new film to be screened tomorrow and Friday right here in Houston, Little Randy. And we will be speaking with him more about this film. Of course, he is a Syrian American. Sam, welcome to Houston.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're pleased to have you on the program, coming and rushing here to this show. We want to talk about the film that you have produced, your latest production that's going to be screened here in Houston tomorrow and Friday. It is all about Syria. We are witnessing nothing less than a total catastrophe in Syria, in Aleppo, and so on. We know Syria is very dear and near to your heart as a Syrian American and so on. So tell us about Syria. We want to know what's happening there and what prompted you to create this film documentary, and tell our listeners about it so they can come and actually see it tomorrow or Friday.
Sure. I was born in Aleppo. And I came to the States about 17 years ago. And it's devastating to see what's going on right now in Syria, and in particular in Aleppo. As you might know, I mean, just early this morning, about like 40 people in Aleppo were killed while they're fleeing the city from, you know, bombing and shelling by Russia and the Syrian regime over there. The main reason for me to make Little Gandhi was to rearrange the Syrian folder for people. Right now, and it's been like this for the last couple of years, anybody you talk to in the West about Syria, right away they think about ISIS, right away they think about extremists, right away they think about anything but what the Syrians are all about. They forgot about who the Syrians are. They forgot about their movement back in 2011 when they first decided to march the streets asking for freedom and dignity, when they marched peacefully for almost a year while they were getting killed, and they were trying to continue and trying to push for a dialogue with the Syrian government before they even ask for the regime to be tumbled over there. They want the emergency rules to be removed. They want equality. They want freedom. And these are the basics that actually we take for granted here in the United States. So I wanted to make a movie about a Syrian peace activist called Ghayas Matar, and he is from the suburb of Damascus, from Daraya, the besieged area of Daraya, who actually initiated that peace movement in 2011. And he was marching the streets with bottles of water and roses, facing down gunfire and violence, where he believed that this is the way to achieve the goal of reaching a dialogue and reaching a change, the change that the Syrians are really looking for. And he was able to convince the activists and the young Syrians to rally behind him. It was just a beautiful scenery back then, you know, to see him with roses and bottles of water. And I wanted to bring that story back. I wanted to dig deep and go back to the beginning, the first protest in the suburb of Damascus, which Ghayas was involved with his friends, and take it all the way through Ghayas' life and unfortunately death at an early age, and then keep going until we see and we talk about how things started and how things unfolded.
So it goes way to the beginning of the Syrian uprising against the regime, calling for a change, as you described, and it goes through the present time almost with what we're witnessing and seeing in different cities and across Syria.
Sure. Yeah, actually, we talk about how things unfolded since his death, because Ghayas Matar's death was in early, like in the revolution over there, in the crisis, about September of 2011. So he witnessed only like 6 months of the uprising. But we talk about how his death actually marked the transition from peaceful movement to an armed crisis. And we take it all the way through our current time right now, briefly, you know, to talk about why we got here, what's the responsibility of the international community. And we hear it from the activists who actually started the whole thing in Syria, the peaceful activists that initiated the movement in Syria.
So those are documented, and that's again tomorrow at Rice University at 7 p.m. and then Friday at the University of Houston at 2 p.m. Now, so obviously you have family back still in Syria, friends, you sure. Speak with them. What do they tell you? How are people coping with this disaster in Syria, especially in Aleppo over the past several months that has been devastated by almost all sides?
Absolutely. I mean, knowing that there is about 12 million displaced people, over 4 to 5 million refugees, and you know, what's documented as far as the victims is about 500,000, and I would say maybe closer to 1 million, because these are the documented victims. There are a lot of undocumented victims in Syria, and there are thousands and thousands of people in prison that we have no idea what happened. We have no even any kind of update on them, and some of them actually the friends of Ghayas Matar and Little Gandhi. We have no idea if they're still alive or not. For sure, we still have some friends in there, and a lot of them, they had the opportunity to leave, and they didn't want to leave. I mean, they feel that this is our land. We have to fight for it. We either, live free or die with dignity, and this is sometimes it's hard to comprehend, you know, while you're talking to them, hearing the bomb shelling in the background, and they don't want to leave their land, and definitely they feel the world has failed the Syrians for sure, and the international community and the leaders of the free world, they haven't done anything to help them out. Actually gave him wrong signals at the beginning of the uprising, when they signaled that they are on their sides, when they signaled that, chemical weapons is a red line. When even the ambassador, which we have in the film, the former ambassador Robert Ford, joined some of the protests in Damascus and Hama, and then the Syrians were left alone. They just left alone. So you talk to them, definitely, it's a situation that's really, really hard to describe. Safety-wise, it's a war zone. I mean, if you're talking about Aleppo, especially east of Aleppo, it's a war zone. And even if you live in the west of Aleppo, I mean, this is just a, 15 minutes ride, if you take a cab or a car. So you can hear everything. You can hear the Russian planes, and you can see the Russian planes flying and bombing, and the Syrian planes flying and bombing. And, and even in Damascus, in the suburb of Damascus, like Daraya, for instance, when they were there, I mean, the barrel bombs, and it's the biggest, for sure, is the biggest humanitarian crisis since World War II. But at the same time, it's the most documented a crisis in a humankind, and this why I feel like the responsibility, it's a huge, and the history is gonna write about this, because we witnessed everything.
Yeah. Now, you described it earlier as an armed crisis, because we are witnessing, I mean, there are a lot of groups also that are getting into Syria, a lot of armed groups, a lot of countries, Arab countries, Westerns, they are pouring arms. They are arming those groups that every other day they come up with a different name,
sure,
all on the expense of the Syrian people. Whether it's the regime bombing them, or Al-Qaeda, or Jabhat al-Nusra, or Al-Fatah, or God knows who, they are just using Syrian land, destroying the country. So it's not just really the Syrian regime we are witnessing. We see horror stories from other groups and other arms pouring in, making it havoc, wreaking havoc throughout the Syrian territory.
I mean, for sure, what I said before is what started with a bottle of water and a rose was forced to become a proxy war that Syrians have really nothing to do with. Mm-hmm. Like, even when there was a ceasefire, a month ago, I think for 48 hours, there was a deal in a meeting between Russia
and
the U.S. Yep. And the Syrians had no representation whatsoever. Mm-hmm. Actually, we were looking for details. What are the details of the ceasefire? We had to wait a couple of days until the details were leaked. So it's pathetic when you look at it. Like, Syrians have nothing to do with it. But we should not forget that the reason we're focusing on the Syrian regime and the Russians right now, because they are the strongest and the more equipped, and the death that's happening by their planes, through their planes, and there are the bombing, it's huge, it's massive, it's negligible if you compare it to other parties that they're killing the Syrians as well, and actually killing even that what we call the Free Syrian armies. I mean, the Free Syrian armies and the Syrians, they've been facing death everywhere they turn, from everybody. But when you look at,
whether it's from the Syrian regime or those other armed groups from everywhere,
but the bombing from the air and by planes using barrel bombs or any kind of shelling using Air Force, that this is the thing that Syrians have been screaming to talking to the international community that has to stop, because they can fight anything else, but they have no protection from the sky. And this is what's killing them. This is what's killing people right now in Aleppo and East Aleppo. These planes, shelling them with all kind of stuff, And that's why we focus on this, because this is, you're talking about Russia, like it's a major power in the world. They're going after thousands of people sitting in a, you know, in a city, and when, even when they're fleeing, they're getting bombed. So it is definitely, it's devastating for sure.
Yeah. What do you think the path to peace is? How could this crisis be ended?
Wow, this is for sure a tough question. Definitely, it would have been much easier if we were talking about this subject 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And I think the real question is what have we done in 2011? What have we done in 2012, 2013, 2014, 15 to stop the crisis? Now we are in 2016, almost in 2017, and we still, it's becoming just a zoo. And if you keep it 2-3 more years, it's going to get even more and more complicated. The way to peace right now, it's honestly, I don't have a straight answer to this, because the players are many. And I think the U.S. has to come to an agreement with Russia. And again, the Syrians are dying every day.
Yes, it's
waiting for an agreement between the Russia and the U.S. to end this crisis.
The superpowers and the other countries that are feeding weapons to all kinds of groups and all kinds of sides. Absolutely. For their own benefits, for whatever that reason is, whether to benefit them directly or to destroy their neighbors or
absolutely. And let me just tell you something. Talking to the activist over there, and the peaceful activist, a lot of them actually, they still peaceful activists, and they want to get back to peace. And this is how they started. This is who the Syrians are. And that's why I wanted to make this film about peace. So hopefully we can get back to peace, because the Syrians are peaceful people and they're asking for nothing but freedom and dignity.
So we encourage our listeners to go and watch this new film documentary. Very clever name, by the way, that is called Little Randy. The film director is here in Houston. He just arrived. He has been joining us live here. Sam Qadi, he is producer and director of this film that will be screened tomorrow at Rice University at 7 p.m. and on Friday at the University of Houston at 2 p.m. I have links on our website, arabvoices.net, for more details and more information about the film and the exact locations at Rice and at the University of Houston. Unfortunately, we are out of time, so I want to thank Sam Qadi. Thank you so much. We greatly appreciate your time and for rushing here directly from the airport to be with us live.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And actually, people who need to know what to do for Syria, tomorrow we have two organizations, Syrian American Council coming from Washington, D.C. with their representative, and Rahma Relief Foundation, a humanitarian foundation, coming with pledges to Aleppo to help the Syrian and the people of Aleppo. So we would love for you to come and join us, listen to that panel, talk to these representatives, talk to us, and it will be a pleasure. And please check the film Facebook page to get the updates and the location. It's the facebook.com/littlegandhimovie to get all the details. Thank you so much.
Very well. Thanks a lot. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. And many thanks to Diego and Dima for their assistance today. Technology Bites is coming up next. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next Wednesday, peace on earth.
What does it look like when leaders from different faiths work together for social change? See for yourself at 7 p.m. on Thursday, December 15th at the Rothko Chapel. The nonprofit dedicated to social justice is hosting Houston's Faith Elders, Social Justice, Social Change in the Presence of the Divine. This conversation with Rabbi Samuel Karf, Reverend William Lawson, and Archbishop Joseph Fiorenza will be moderated by award-winning journalist Melanie Lawson. The three professional clergy have worked together on social justice issues around Houston for decades. The event will offer a window into their interfaith work and a glimpse into how those efforts have influenced their personal spirituality and ministry. Rabbi Karf is Rabbi Emeritus at Congregation Beth Israel. Reverend Lawson is the founding pastor of Wheeler Avenue Baptist Church. And Archbishop Fiorenza is Archbishop Emeritus of Galveston, Houston. The Rothko Chapel is located at 3900 Yupon, KPFT, Houston.
When you donate a car, truck, motorcycle, SUV, RV, or boat, we can turn what's often a burden into great educational programming. As the year comes to a close, we want to encourage you to let it go now.